3, 2, 1. The complaint was filed in Fairbanks District Court by defense attorney Dick Madsen, whose office is here. Madsen says the federal government has immunity statutes in its criteria on oil spill and oil spill reporting. They require a person to report a spill or face criminal charges. Yet in this case, Madsen says Hazelwood reported the Exxon Valdez oil spill, but is still being prosecuted.
Obviously, this poses some Fifth Amendment problems, constitutional problems, because if a person commits what could be a crime, they normally have a right to remain silent. So Congress enacted this statute, which is, in essence, a trade-off. In other words, by requiring someone to report a oil spill, and if they're responsible for the spill, then they said, okay, because we're requiring you to report it, because we think it's more important to go in there and clean it up fast without having to worry about somebody keeping their mouth quiet, you know, shut and not reporting because they're afraid they might get in trouble, then by doing this, they are granting immunity from the report itself or the exploitation or use of that report to prosecute.
Madsen has filed a motion to dismiss the case in the state courts, but he wants a ruling from a federal judge to prohibit the prosecuting attorneys from continuing to press the state's case.
It is so important, and that the prosecution is so unfair, and it's basically harassment. It's a clear violation of a federal statute that only the federal court can come in and put a stop to. Not saying that the state judge, of course, has not had a chance to act on this. He has not ruled on it. So we're not saying that the state judge has done anything improper or anything of the sort. We're just saying that the prosecution should not be doing this because it is a clear violation of the federal law, and that as such, the federal court has the power and the duty to step in and stop it and enjoin it until this is determined.
The complaint names Anchorage District Attorney Dwayne McConnell and three assistant DAs as the defendants. That office is withholding comment until the defendants receive a copy of the complaint. Madsen says after the state responds to the charges, a federal court judge will rule to either stop the state from prosecuting Hazelwood or let the case go ahead. He doesn't expect the complaint to interfere with the state court schedule. Since the next proceeding there isn't until the end of November, he expects the federal court to rule sooner than that. Hazelwood faces six state charges in the grounding of the Exxon Valdez oil tanker last March, operating a watercraft while intoxicated, reckless endangerment, negligent discharge of oil, and three felony criminal mischief counts. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornson. 3, 2, 1. The city expects to see its property tax revenues drop by nearly $3 million. That's because of the tax cap voters approved, cutting down the amount of money to be raised through the mill rate compared to last year. The change has created a $3.2 million gap between projected income and expenses. City Manager Brian Phillips will spend the next week looking for $3 million to cut before sending a balanced budget to the City Council.
We'll be meeting with department heads, and we'll be prioritizing city services and those services that are essential in terms of public safety and public health and public welfare that fall above $14.8 million budget revenue cap. Will be recommended in the budget, and those that fall below that will not be recommended in the 1990 budget.
Phillips presented the new revenue projections to the council yesterday in a work session and got a strong reaction from some council members on how the tax cap was computed. By strictly following the amendment voters approved earlier this year, Phillips estimates that the tax cap would result in a property tax levy of 3.9 mils. City Council member Jerry Cleworth maintains that's too low. In the formula used to figure the base year for the tax cap, the city subtracted from the revenue picture money paid on old debts in 1988. That put a $1.3 million dent in the revenue side to compute the base year formula. But in 1988, the money to pay principal and interest on those old debts came from the general fund balance, not property taxes from that year. So Cleworth maintains that $1 million should not be taken out, and his calculations would mean a higher revenue picture for the city and a mill rate of 5.3. Cleworth believes that's what the authors of the initiative to roll back the mill rate had in mind.
I think I am speaking for the intent of the authors. I believe I'm right on that, but if other people disagree, that's fine. Unfortunately, it's going to be quite devastating.
Cleworth was in the minority with his projection, with Councilmember Bill Wally on his side. The two are considered conservatives on the council, but their stand yesterday prompted some to jokingly refer to them as the Liberals. The city council will get a budget from the city manager in a week and a half. Then they will have to look at the income and expenses and decide on what cuts in city services and personnel have to be made or what other revenue sources can be tapped to meet the needs. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornson.
Well, you're going to see about 15,000 red ribbons on the street. That's what's been distributed so far. On Tuesday at the Chamber Luncheon, the Lieutenant Governor will give the kickoff speech for Red Ribbon Week. There will be activities in all of the schools. We have different kinds of activities, including a drug dog demonstration out at the airport. Just bunches and bunches of activities that are taking place. And, of course, that's what the Red Ribbon Week Committee was all about, was just coordinating all those different activities.
Obviously, a lot of folks are going to be very discouraged if they don't have those places to put their garbage, and we'll have garbage all over the roads and all over the borough. Come springtime, it'll be the biggest mess that you can have, a public health and safety problem. So until such time as the Assembly can take a definitive action and come up with a plan, either endorse the mayor's or an alternate plan, we have to do something to provide this service to the people in the borough. So I came forth with this ordinance to fund the dumpsters for another 6 months to give us a little bit more time to implement some plan to solve the problem.
Last year, the local September jobless rate was higher than 11% in the Fairbanks North Star borough. This year, it's down to 8.8%. But that figure is still up a full percentage point compared to August. State labor economist Neil Freed says the increase was expected.
It's not atypical for the unemployment rate to start climbing in September and continue climbing probably through January. It doesn't always happen, because we have your schools coming back, university reopening, and that usually boosts employment. Sometimes it boosts employment more than we see seasonal losses like in tourism and construction. But this year, the rate did go up in September. But that's not unusual.
Even though the number of local people collecting unemployment increased last month, Freed says statistics show the number of people working also went up.
Actually, employment continued to climb in September in Fairbanks. Now, some sectors lost employment, such as trade, which tourism, you see a lot of tourism industry in the trade sector, and that lost ground in September. Manufacturing lost a little bit of ground, and services, which is also tourism plays a very big role in, also lost the largest amount of ground in September. But actually, some of that was offset, or was more than offset, by increases in government. If you're looking seasonally, you have the university reopening, so you see all those people going back to work. And then, of course, you know, the school district, the same goes for the local school district. So you see a big increase typically, of course, in September for your educational institutions. And that increase actually more than offset the decreases in your retail trade and your services.
Freed expects the unemployment rate to continue increasing now through the winter months. He says it probably won't begin to go down again until the spring. In September, more than 2,600 people collected unemployment in the Fairbanks area. The statewide unemployment rate climbed last month to more than 7%. In August, it was below 6%. Freed says the increase was mostly due to the demobilization of the oil spill cleanup effort. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornson.
And that particular subject is a subject that I think reasonable minds can differ on. But I think if you want to draw the conclusion about how we approach the situation with our children, you can only draw one conclusion. And that is that we have to recriminalize marijuana in the state of Alaska. We have to send kids in our state a message that we're not going to live in a schizophrenic society, that the message is going to be very clear, that we are going to take an active and a participatory role in ending the scourge of drugs in our society. Perhaps it needs to be spent for better prevention programs, that it may need to be spent for better treatment programs, that they could do it in the form of grants for these types of programs, or maybe it could be used to spend to enhance law enforcement. I don't have a problem with any of those. The ingredient that I think is the most important, that we as Alaskans show a commitment, that we engage ourselves in the process.
3, 2, 1. The Public Utilities Board has spent the last 3 weeks going over the proposed budget. What some of the board members don't like is the bottom line. On paper, the system would operate at a $2.4 million deficit. Money to make up the difference and balance the budget would come from the utility system's bank balance. Some PUB members are concerned about what that will mean next year when budget time rolls around and there's less of a balance to draw from. Another thing which complicates the picture is MUS will get $1.5 million in 1990 for selling one of its assets. That money has been incorporated into the budget too, but since it's one-time capital income, some board members feel it should not be included, since it will just mean that much more of a deficit next year. One solution would be to raise utility rates in the areas that aren't making money so they can pay for themselves. Even if the PUB agreed to recommend rate hikes, they would still have to get through the City Council. Some board members are not very sure that would happen. An expensive line item in the budget is what's spent on wages and salaries. With union contracts still undecided, the PUB could recommend cutbacks there, but that will mean lost jobs, and some board members are concerned about that. So a mixture of the two is being looked at now. The latest proposal would increase electric rates by more than 6%. And water rates by 15%. And by operating at last year's wage and salary level, most of the deficit would be offset. PUB board member Gary Wilkins suggested the plan as one possible answer. The board hesitated to approve it last night. The rate increases would be hard enough to recommend, but the question of how many jobs would be affected by operating at 1989 pay levels is still uncertain. Wilkins sees holding the line on wages as something that must be considered.
I just think that the utility, when it's going to lose $3.7 million, should look at how the utility is run. One of the major factors in the utility is the wages and benefits. That has to be explored. And I'm not sure how that can be done technically, man by man, but it must be done in order to stop the hemorrhage of cash.
Another suggestion made last night would be to consider a hiring freeze. Jobs that have been left vacant for a while would remain vacant, and money could be saved on those wages. Not all the PUB members are behind one plan yet. Another meeting is scheduled tonight where they hope to get a better picture of what the job situation might look like under the latest proposal. And even if board members think that picture is okay, the idea of recommending electric and water rate hikes to the City Council is another big step to take. If the latest proposal doesn't work, they can go back to the drawing board, but will have to do so quickly since the budget needs to go to the City Council in another week. And the board could always go back to recommending the proposed budget it has to work with and worry next year about what could be an even bigger deficit. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornson. 1. The MUS budget that was recommended to the Public Utilities Board showed a $2 million operating deficit. The PUB made changes that would reduce that deficit to less than $500,000. But they did it by proposing increases in water and electric rates and some staff reductions. And as much as they don't like to propose such things, they don't have high hopes that the City Council will agree to take those steps. But the PUB members feel they should present a budget to the council that makes ends meet without using up their cash reserves. That means making sure revenues match expenditures as much as possible, and that means endorsing a 6.5% increase in city electric customers' bills and a 15% increase in the city's water rates. And while that would raise more than $1 million, just under $1 million would be cut from wages and salaries. That would mean 12 job positions remaining unfilled and the loss of 4 or 5 other jobs. While it isn't a dream budget by anyone's standards, utilities manager Virgil Gillespie says he could live with it.
It's going to be more restrictive than it was in 1989. We're looking at vacancies that we had not filled because of lack of funding, leaving them vacant, creating some more vacancies by eliminating some positions. So we'll have a smaller staff than we had in 89. And there are proposed rate increases to the customer.
But even as PUB members somberly approve this budget recommendation, they know that the city council probably won't buy it. In fact, the two council members who are also on the PUB don't think the recommendation will make it through the council's budget process. Councilmember Jim Hayes.
I would say, just from observation and just from knowing each individual council member the way that I do, and just from the last 2 years, and even with the new council members, I would be really surprised if they adopted it. The 6.5 in electric and 15 in the water, it would surprise me.
Part of the frustration for PUB members is that the city takes 7% of the utility system's revenues for its own budget. Since it's municipally owned, the council is entitled to that money and could even take more. But when they don't approve rate increases, MUS loses that operating revenue to the city and has no way to make up for it. So the utilities continue to operate in the red. The telephone utility is the only one which makes money for MUS. PUB chairman and new city council member Bob Sundberg doesn't think the council will approve the rate increases in water and electric either, but he does see the budget recommendation as the PUB doing its job.
Serving on the utility board and also on the city council makes it very, you have to wear two hats. A responsible utility operation is hopefully what the board, you know, is going to transmit over to the city council. This is what is needed to keep this utility financially sound and operating. When I get over on the city council seat, of course, then it turns into a matter of passing on those same increases that this board says is needed. The only other area is additional cuts within that utility budget in materials or labor. Them are the only options we have.
PUB members know some of their figures won't get past the city council. For one, they aren't budgeting more than $1 million that the council takes through a special assessment, which is scheduled to come to an end this year. But the city council is planning to extend the deadline on that and continue taking that money from MUS. And the PUB is getting $1.5 million for selling an asset next year. The board would like to simply reinvest that money and incorporate the interest into subsequent budgets. But that's $1.5 million that the cash-strapped city, facing cuts of its own, will find hard to overlook. The city council will do what it sees fit with the MUS budget. And if the council doesn't adopt the proposed changes, MUS could be back at looking at a $2 million problem by the end of next year. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornson.
You've heard it said that you are what you eat. No one more agrees with that bit of nutritional wisdom than Alaska's native people. So much so that it was an issue brought before this year's Alaska Federation of Natives annual convention.
Now therefore be resolved that the elders would like to see the continuation of traditional native foods at our native gatherings in rural and especially urban settings without interference by the health department restricting our native people from carrying on their traditional ways.
One interior elder gave testimony reflecting the feelings of many in attendance that native ways needed no outside regulation.
For hundreds of years, we've been putting up salmon strips. And everybody in Harbor, we put it up. It seems like now they want us to package it. And dry meat, just like they do with the jerkies. You see them in packages. There's some friends of mine from the Arctic Slope asking me if they want salmon strips. And if you don't have it packaged, you can't give it to them. And that's what it's going to boil down to, even with our dry meat.
I come from the village of New Laro, and this is the third year that I did bring down some salmon strips and dried meat for our elders. And I was afraid the other day to bring it over, but I took a chance to bring it over for the elders to help themselves on it. But anyhow, when I was growing up in the village, I remember my grandmother used to put up salmon heads in barrels. Okay, she'd put a layer of salmon eggs, split the salmon heads, put a layer of that, layer of eggs, and so on till she finished, till she filled the barrels. Okay, we'll ferment that for about a week. And okay, I'm 68 years old, I'm still in good health. That hasn't done anything to my health at all.
Athabascan Audrey Armstrong spoke in favor of the resolution, telling a story about how at the National Indian Education Conference, held the weekend before in Anchorage, a potlatch had to be canceled and instead a private party held because of regulatory interference.
I'm not against the health department. I'm not against any of the agencies that's restricting us. But this is our time for sharing, and I think like they're referring it to the AFN board, but AFN also needs to let us know that it's not just going to die at the AFN board or at one time, that this is a continued problem here for us that live in the urban areas. And every time we have some kind of activity or something, it seems like all kinds of different agencies are always pulling at us to pull something of our tradition away. So we can't just lay down and say, sure, we'll listen to your regulations without questioning it.
While sentiment seemed strong for the non-interference resolution, there were those who saw merit in some regulatory control. Bill Thomas of Saxman.
I have a counter for that last comment. I'm a survivor of botulism from eating fermented heads. I'm not speaking against the food as such, but I would be reluctant to remove the ability for some to adopt this with the wording in there where it says without interference by the health department. If we pass this in its present form, and anything does occur in these preparations, my observation tells me that there would be no responsibilities or liabilities because all the sanctions would have the blessings of this convention. I offer that as an observation, Mr. Chairman.
An observation the AFM board will have some time to deal with since the resolution was referred back to them for further study, providing the 37-member board with some traditional food for thought. In McGrath, I'm Mike Lane.
Three, two, one. The Fairbanks North Star Borough Assembly gave the go-ahead for the special election with the provision that the bonds will not be sold unless the cost is partially reimbursed by the state. The Assembly is hoping that by having an election before the year is through, the governor will recommend the bond funding in his budget, and the legislature will act to reimburse the district for 80% of the cost if voters approve it. The issue will become more complicated next month, when the Assembly is expected to put another proposal for school administrative office space up for approval during that same December 5th special election. At least one of the new Assembly members, Harold Gillum, thinks the Assembly may be rushing into things. Gillum tried to get the special election pushed back until February, when the picture may be a little more clear.
To give us some more time to evaluate the proposal of the administration building, I don't think that a two-week period of time by the Borough Assembly putting something before the voters is going to give adequate time, if there is any debate, to the voters. I think that really there should be a longer period of time. We don't have all of our ducks in a row yet.
But most of the others on the Assembly didn't want to wait any longer. Assembly member Chris Birch.
I think if we wait till we get all our ducks in a row, we will probably have all our ducks in a row I'm not sure we'll get anything accomplished here.
And when Governor Cooper presents his budget proposal to legislators on December 15th, Assemblymember Don Lowell wants these bonds to be included.
I think it's very important that these funds be included in the governor's budget figures, and if we delay the election, they will not be. And I think we should go ahead. Again, we've been fooling around this thing for a great period of time.
And since the Assembly has been working the last couple of months to get the bond proposals done in time for a December special election, Bonnie Williams doesn't want to put it off any longer either.
We've been working our little hearts out here and fighting with one another, unfortunately, in trying to achieve a December date because it was considered so important for the governor's budget and for the start of the legislature. I don't think that we should torpedo that at this point and move it to February and lose everything that we fought for.
After the Assembly voted down Gillum's attempt to move the election date back, they approved the ordinance that would authorize a vote on December 5th. If voters say yes to the new elementary school and other projects, the total cost of the bond issue will be more than $35 million when you include the interest payments. Some $28 million of that would be paid by the state if the borough gets the 80% reimbursement that Assembly members believe the legislature will approve early in next year's session. The issue of space for the school administration offices is a separate one. The Assembly will consider proposals for that project next month, and they hope to have one to recommend to voters in time for that December election. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornson.
With the dumpster costs, which you can see before you, and any new transfer station costs, they come out just about the same. By charging fees, which I'm not sure has the support of the Assembly anyway, and continuing to tax at the top amount of our tax cap, we still can't afford to pay for the service. This $1 million in this ordinance is not a loan. What you're doing is you're taking the money from the general fund that area-wide taxpayers have paid and supporting a non-area-wide service that the city of Fairbanks and the city of North Pole are not enjoying. We couldn't pay it back next year even if it was a loan because it exceeds the total amount of tax that we bring in for that service. There's an ordinance now being proposed by an assembly person that's coming up in 2 weeks that will give me some indication of where the assembly stands as far as fees, and that's regarding the tipping fees of the landfill. The fact is, if we can't pay our bills and when we contract with the private sector, they do expect to be paid, they'll quit serving us. And I can't write a check if we don't have money in the bank.
Three, two, one. George Sundborg first came to Alaska 51 years ago to work as a reporter for the Alaska Daily Empire in Juneau. That was back when Juneau, with its population of 9,000, was the largest city in the territory. And 1 year later, territorial governor Ernest Greening arrived in Alaska. What followed was a close association between the two for the next 30 years. On KUAC's Sunday at Noon program, Sundberg told Susan McGinnis that Greening was a man with a vision for Alaska. And unlike previous territorial governors, Greening set to work to make the legislature see that vision as well.
Ernest came with this great vision of what he felt could occur up here in this northern territory. And he tried to stir within the legislature a similar desire to put into effect the measures that would be required to make it possible for people to live here and to have productive lives. And he had a very difficult uphill battle for many years before he was able to accomplish very much. The solutions which he put before them were things that were anathema to certain vested interests which were already in power in Alaska, and particularly the number one opponent of all of the greening initiatives was the Alaska salmon industry, which was owned outside of Alaska, which had a power over the legislature which was in no degree less controlling than that which Big Oil has over the legislature of Alaska in 1989.
But greening eventually was successful. Sundborg says he overcame opponents and the strong salmon industry interests with hard work.
They had, as a new opponent, someone with the ability and the leadership qualities which they had never come up against in Alaska before. And this was in the person of Governor Ernest Greening. And he, for the first time, took the salmon industry and other vested interests on for battle. And it took maybe 10 or 15 years before he, by dint of persuasion and by trying to get good men to run for office, and by putting the idea across to the public, which elected the people who went to the legislature, succeed in attaining one by one objectives which he had set out as steps on the road that ultimately would lead to self-government and statehood.
Sundborg later went on to work on Greening's campaign for the U.S. Senate in 1958. Greening was successful and served in the Senate for 10 years. But as modern media technology has grown in prominence in political campaigns to this day, it was already beginning to wield its power in 1968. And Sundborg says that contributed in part to Greening's defeat for re-election by Mike Gravel.
Gravel had a very persuasive film made, supposedly about his career, although we felt it had a lot of false claims in it. But it was played all over the state very effectively, and when the votes were counted, he had beaten Ernest Greening. Greening was at that time 81 years of age. He was running for a term which was going to last for 6 years. He insisted on coming to Alaska and speaking in every inhabited place, and the effect, I think, on the people who saw him and heard him was that this was, in truth, a very old man. And the fact was that had he been elected, he would not have served out his course, his term, because he did die in 1974. He was still a great man, even though old.
What do you think he'd think of his state now? His territory and his state?
Well, I think I know. He was very proud of the way Alaska had developed. He came up and traveled all over the state just a year before he died, and he told me that it was the happiest trip he had ever made to Alaska, that he saw so many of his dreams being fulfilled up here, and he met so many people who were so kind to him, even though he was no longer in public office. So it was a nice valedictory.
In addition to his close association with Greening, Sundborg played a role in Alaska history himself. The journalist was involved in the effort to gain statehood and won a seat in the Alaska Constitutional Convention. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornson.
Very rarely, and I think that's because we really don't have the trick-or-treaters out that we used to. I mean, a lot of them now are going to parties being sponsored by schools and church groups and things like that, so we don't have that much. But there has been some occasions in the past years that we've had some food tampered with. Sometimes we keep very busy, and then other times Halloween's go over quite well. We usually find that when Halloween is in the first and the middle of the week, that we don't have as many problems as we do on the weekends.
Just about all the candidates who took part in the forum seem to have at least one common objective, to diversify the economy. But of course, they differ on how they would do that. Candidate Ryle White of Anchorage says one way to create jobs in the state is to move the capital to Willow. White says this shouldn't be a dead issue. The move, he says, would create plenty of jobs in the construction industry while improving the state's transportation system. Steve McAlpine says when talking about diversifying the state's economy, we're really talking about diversifying just 15% of it. The other 85% is reliant upon the oil industry, and McAlpine says that interest needs to be protected.
timber in this day and age is doing very well. Tourism during this year may very well break every record of those heretofore. Fishing, although it isn't the highest value catch, was the highest volume catch of any year. And so to talk about diversifying the economy is really to defy reality. We are dependent upon oil. We are dependent upon the extraction of natural resources. And for anyone to tell you otherwise is simply taking the ostrich approach to our future. Issues of commonality that affect us have to do with the opening of Anwar. This state's economy is not going to be the same if we as citizens don't stand together to accomplish that in an environmentally safe fashion.
But fellow Democrat and former Anchorage Mayor Tony Knowles says the state is already overwhelmingly dependent on the oil industry.
We face economic challenges of an economy and state government that is precariously dependent upon a single source of income, oil, whose known production is in decline. We see a precious and life-sustaining environment eroded by thoughtless action and shameful inattention. We cannot meet the challenge, we cannot live the dream, unless we come together as a people. Our test is one of spirit, not barrels pumped.
Republican Senator Rick Halford says the budget and economy question does not necessarily concern a lack of revenue. Halford says Alaska does not have a budget shortfall, it has a spending surplus. Like everybody else, he says, it's time to trim the budget, but he says not at the expense of the permanent fund.
We don't need new debt. We don't need to be taking from our future. We need to face today's realities with today's resources. Taxes and government size everywhere else have to deal with each other one-to-one. They don't have this great mechanism to pass the burden and the bill on to their children that we do. We should avoid that. We should defend the future against the expedience of today. Often when you say that the budget has to be reduced, someone asks for a complete plan. Well, nobody has a complete plan of how to cut the state budget. But you don't drop out of grade school because you don't know which graduate school to go to. You start by stopping the increases.
Halford says state payroll can be reduced substantially without laying anyone off. Republican Senator Arla Sturgalewski says streamlining government, cutting red tape, will help with that reduced budget spending. She says equally important is that the state remembers not to export two things when developing her resources. Number one, the profits, and number two, the children due to lack of jobs. Anchorage businessman Jim Campbell says the key to running the governor's office is to show strong leadership in the budget in relating to industry and to local governments. And that's something he says has been missing for a while. I'm Michael Jones.
3, 2, 1. Governor Cooper wants to establish an education endowment fund. It would divert earnings from the Alaska Permanent Fund into a special education fund. In another 15 years, Cooper says lawmakers could count on that money for education, since state revenues are expected to fall off. Cooper has been trying to build support for the fund as he travels to different cities in Alaska. The proposal still needs to get approval from the state Senate before voters could be asked to have a say on the matter next fall. Despite its critics, Cooper says the plan should be put before the voters.
Somehow, we have to figure out how we're going to make Alaska work in the next 10 or 15 years. This, I believe, was an intelligent proposal, and I think that people ought to have the right to vote on it. It's one of the few ways that I know of to assure that education will be adequately funded in 10 or 15 or 20 years. I think that it's requirement that a small sacrifice be made, or a sacrifice that we interpret as being small, makes it one that's uniquely suited for a public vote. And I don't hazard a guess as to how the public would vote on this. I really don't. I never have. But I think the Senate ought to think about letting the public vote on this proposal. And that's what it comes to.
It's a very poor idea, and basically it's a scam to raid the permanent fund.
Jim Widener of Fairbanks is one big critic of the plan. Since the endowment would be built with permanent fund earnings, it would mean a cut in the growth of the permanent fund dividends Alaskans get every year. Widener told members of the Fairbanks North Star Borough Assembly last week what he thinks of the education endowment.
This is such a harebrained screwball scheme. It does not deserve ballot consideration.
Widener took his arguments to the borough assembly because assembly members were being asked for support. A resolution before the group would have urged the legislature to put the issue to voters so they could decide the merits of an education endowment fund. But assembly members did not support the resolution, with 9 members opposed and only 2 in support. The fund wouldn't be available until the year 2005, and assembly members doubt that it will have raised enough money to cover the costs of education 15 years from now. Assemblymember Chris Birch doesn't want to tie anyone's hands that far into the future.
This assembly, future assemblies, in fact, the people of the state will continue to support education in whatever capacity they need to, whether there's in a permanent fund endowment or not. I think in the matter of the endowment, my particular concern is tying the hands of our children into committing funds. We're up to some turbulent times. We don't know what the future holds, and I think that it would be premature to be committing those funds.
But even though local officials don't think the plan will work, the issue could still go before voters next year. If the legislature endorses it, voters will be asked to change the state constitution to create the Education Endowment Fund. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornson.